Welcome back. My name's Dan Jones. I'm an author, broadcaster, professional Templar botherer, and the historical consultant for a certain medieval drama. I'm ringing up those closest to Nightfall to get a peek behind the curtains and learn more about the characters portrayed. I'm going to keep saying this every episode. There are spoilers ahead. There are spoilers ahead. Make sure you've watched Nightfall before you continue. Unless for some reason you enjoy spoilers, that's masochistic, but that's your lookout. We're on the third episode this week. The third episode. Make sure you caught up with the third episode. I'm not going to say that anymore. Now, in this episode of the podcast, I'll be speaking to Olivia Ross and Ed Stoppard about the two ruling French monarchs, how they transferred their characters to the screen, and some things you might not have known about them. The characters, not the actors, that is. Before we get going, though, let's recap episode 3, and where shall we start? Well, how about with Godfrey? After being sliced up like he's whatever the medieval equivalent is of sashimi, I think probably salted herring, Godfrey is finally laid to rest.
All flesh must perish, but even in the shadow of death, hope springs eternal.
Nerd detail, he has a cloth placed over his face with the seal of the Templars on it. That's two knights on a single horse. Being dead isn't stopping Godfrey's power over the Templars, because Landry and Tancred are off on a quest to find his real identity. They go to Castle de Caux.
Did Godfrey ever tell you how he became a Templar?
They don't find any answers, but they do see some pretty sweet wolf graffiti and come back with Baron a not especially friendly Saracen who gives them the pretty unwelcome news that the Grail is going to destroy them all.
Paris would burn.
Not before we get to episode 10. Please, cryptic Saracen prisoner dude, we're only just getting into all this.
Your temple will burn.
Parsival, meanwhile, is having a rough time getting over his ex, which I think is fairly standard when your ex has been shot through the neck with a bolt from a whale crossbow and has indirectly sent you on a wild goose chase to give a sword to a load of Templars, and now you have to sleep in a hayloft.
Parsival!
Anyway,
sleep well.
Parsival hasn't given up on getting his own back on Roland, and now he's doing it from the black uniform of a Templar sergeant.
Well, I learned how to swing a sword.
Unfortunately, he hates getting out of bed in the morning, much to Gawain's annoyance.
Does that hurt?
Yes!
Over in the royal court, meanwhile, Queen Joan has been eating too many of those pickled herrings. Actually, scratch that. She has morning sickness. And that's bad news, given that the whole court knows it's 2 years since she shared the king's bed. This is the Middle Ages, and miracles definitely do happen, but there's only one Immaculate Conception, and this definitely isn't it. Sorry, that's actually disgusting. Now, our anti-hero Denogore is just the right side of being disturbingly hands-on with a princess who calls him uncle, while the princess Isabella is just the wrong side of being hands-on with Louise, who frankly looks like he's having the time of his life. First, he had the whole court going with his pretend-to-be-a-servant trick, and now, well, it looks like there could well be another non-Immaculate Conception coming up at court. One's a mistake, but two just starts to look like carelessness on the part of the royal family. On which note, no more of those vomit noises, because actually they're turning my stomach now. Let's get down to today's podcast. Last time on the podcast, we were talking about the Templars, who are a fusion of real Templar archetypes and characters from Templar-related legend. But in the royal family, it works a bit differently. So let's take them one by one, starting with King Philip IV. Now, Philip IV was known as Le Bel, the Fair, which I've always considered ironic since he was one of the most badass people in French history, certainly before 1990 soccer star Eric Cantona and Le Chiffre from James Bond. But actually, his nickname, Le Bel, referred to the fact that he was supposedly very good-looking. There's one chronicle account that describes him as tall and handsome, addicted to hunting, standing a good palm's breadth higher than everyone else, so tall that his feet nearly touched the ground when he was in the saddle. Now, whether or not we believe this, I'm not sure. We should bear in mind that Philip had a terrible track record for falling out with people. And what he usually did when that happened was to accuse them of heresy, sodomy, sorcery, and conspiracy, and then have them punished with everything from banishment to being flayed alive. On one occasion, a French bishop described him as a useless owl, which in the Middle Ages was a pretty big insult since owls were deemed attractive but notorious for their stupidity. Guess what happened to the bishop? I'll give you a clue. It involved heresy, sodomy, sorcery and conspiracy. In fact, we've had a hint of this part of Philip's character early on in Nightfall. De Nogare, in this instance, was on the end of it.
If I find out you disobeyed me, by God, I shall see you hanged from Montfaucon.
In Nightfall, Philip's married to Queen Joan, and she, too, is based on a real historical figure. In this case, Joanna, or Juana, or Jeanne, depending on your preferred spelling, Queen of Navarre. I'll stick with Joan to avoid confusion. She was a well-endowed noblewoman in her own right. She was Countess of Champagne and Queen of the Spanish Kingdom of Navarre. She married Philip when she was 11, and her power was limited by his. But she was really quite ballsy when she needed to be. In 1297, for example, she raised her own army and sent it into battle against a rebellious noble in Champagne. Now, it's probably important to mention that, historically speaking, Queen Joan died in 1305. By my calculation, that means in Nightfall she ought to have been dead for at least a year. Remember, all the signs are that we're in 1306 here. Right at the start of the series, Landry told us that.
It's been 15 years.
How long again was that, Landry?
15 years right. Since we lost that.
So 15 plus the date of the fall of Acre, 1291, is 1306. So yes, Joan would definitely have been dead. But okay, who's counting?
15!
Oh, right, whatever. The point is, even if time has been bent a little bit out of shape to serve the plot of the show, in Philip and Joan, as well as their daughter Isabella and several others at court, we're dealing with dramatic representations of real people from the pages of the history books. They really would have interacted with Templars. The Templars had been helping out with French accounts and finances for more than a century by this point, and they really did have all that amazing stained glass in their private chapel, which, if you're wondering, is the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris, built by Philip's granddad, Louis IX, to house his collection of holy relics. But enough of that. Time for me to get my phone book out again and ring up the two people best placed to talk everything medieval French royalty.
Hello.
Here's Olivia Ross on why she took on the character of Queen Joan.
Well, I have to say, what made me most interested and excited about the project were the people involved. So it was meeting Dominic and Douglas. I think it was my second meeting for the job.
You'll recognise showrunner Dominic Minghella from the first episode of the podcast, and we're going to be talking to director Douglas MacKinnon later in the series.
The way they spoke about it made me... That's what made me the most, you know, interested. Especially for a woman, there's a tendency of being like, oh, is this going to be only a male-heavy show, you know, in which you're only a love interest, which is not that interesting, quite frankly, you know? But then the way they spoke about it, and they were planning on developing the character, and then the more I read the scripts, I was like, oh my God, it's amazing, because it's not at all just, you know, the female parts are not just sidekicks and not, you know, not just love interests. They really have, like, an integral part to the story. I mean, of course, the world is interesting and, you know, like... It's always such a gift for an actor to be able to enter, you know, a different time or a different culture or, something where there's going to be so much to explore and so much to discover. And but what made this interesting for me was that the parts and not just the male parts, but also the female parts were really interesting and really rich.
We'll be hearing more about Queen Joan from Olivia a little later. But first, what was it like working with her on-screen other half, Ed Stoppard?
And Ed is just, I mean, I just love Ed. He's, first, he's really funny, which is really nice to work with.
Funny until he mentions heresy, conspiracy and sodomy, obviously.
And again, like, I felt, you know, as soon as we started working together, we were on the same wavelength, and... He's just got such amazing cheekbones as well. The camera just I don't know, like, interacts with him really, really well. He's just Philip completely, you know, like from the moment we met, I was just like, he's so perfect for this part. And it's really nice when you have an actor with who you know you can go really far, and you can, you know, do these scenes which are really kind of, you know, quite harsh or scary or, you know, or violent, but you feel incredibly safe. And you both know that you can go there together because you feel so safe.
He really does have a regal look to him. We see the king practicing his sword-fighting skills with Landry in the first episode of Nightfall, and we heard in the last episode of the podcast all about the knight's strict boot camp. But it turns out that Ed didn't have to go through the same training they did.
Look, as long as I can be better than Graham Chapman, then I'm fine. Do you remember Graham? Do you remember in Monty Python the Holy Grail? Can you remember his sword fight with John Cleese? The bloke who actually did teach me stage combat at drama school 20 years ago, his dad was the fight coordinator on Monty Python the Holy Grail. And I think indeed, you know, in the kind of amazing fight between the Black Knight and the Green Knight that Arthur witnesses, he's inside one of those suits of armor. Anyway, he said John Cleese was actually really good. But he said Graham Chapman, he said, didn't matter what I told him, didn't matter what I did, he basically, every sword stroke was like he was playing a forward defense stroke in cricket. He couldn't get him to do anything else. And when you watch it, I promise you, watch it back, watch it on YouTube, watch Graham Chapman fighting John Cleese. And every single sword stroke, he looks like he's playing a cricket stroke. It's quite remarkable. But so as long as I was better than him, that was my benchmark. And as long as I got over that, I was satisfied.
If you haven't seen that clip from Monty Python, you watch the whole film for that scene alone. Graham Chapman does seem to be going for the easy runs with his batting stance. Actually, if you're unfamiliar with cricket, it's probably best to move on rather than explain. We might be here a while. It's funny Ed should bring up The Holy Grail, Monty Python's comedy from 1975. It's perhaps one of the best, as well as possibly the silliest, representations of the Grail Quest. I've mentioned previously how Landry seems to be a nod to Lancelot, while Parsifal is lifted straight from Arthurian legend. And I guess that means we've got the knights who say knee and a murderous rabbit to look forward to. Anyway, back to Ed.
The character himself, you know, he's in this very kind of conflicted maelstrom of having to kind of deal with political machinations and pope-shaped problems and domestic issues within his marriage, not to mention financial issues. And then there's always the threat of war with England, and then succession and marrying his daughter. And my feeling was that, you know, he wasn't a kind of Richard the Lionheart type king. All of this stuff didn't just kind of sit very sort of easily on his shoulders, and he just carried all the weights of the crown with kind of ease and nonchalance. It was, in some respects, quite kind of tortuous playing the role, because I think it probably was quite tortuous for him.
The real King Philip IV is a fairly infamous character, emphasis on fair there. But it sounds like Ed has focused on the weight of responsibility being the driving factor behind some of the more unsavoury deeds that I'm sure we'll get to see later in Nightfall. Now, Ed also had some interesting insight into how he further developed King Philip's character.
There's the kind of public king, and then there's the private king. That's the sort of first thing. I mean, the way he behaves, in the kind of Great Hall, in front of ambassadors from this, that, and the other country, is going to be different to how he behaves in his bedroom when he's having an argument with his wife, or privately getting advice from his, you know, chief counselors or whatever. So there's that thing to bear in mind. But I mean, I seem to remember actually quite early on, I said to Douglas, I said, you know, Douglas, I've got a feeling that, you know, he's not going to look at people so much. We're so used to kind of looking at people, you know, the person you're conversing with. And I sort of said, I'm not sure he'll do so much of that because they'll all be looking at him, but he won't necessarily be looking at them all the time because he knows that, you know, as soon as he says jump, everyone's going to say, how high, Your Majesty? So you kind of, in some respects, don't have to work so hard or have to kind of, you know, you're a bit more judicious about when you bring the kind of full weight of the crown to bear on an individual or on a situation or something. And I seem to remember Douglas kind of going, no. And my memory is he kind of batted that idea aside. But I think I kind of quietly just sort of tried to slip those moments in because that just sort of felt, that felt kind of, because, you know, there's the status things. How do you portray status and stuff? And that sort of felt to me that actually, you know, a king might choose his moment rather than just sort of sitting there the whole time on his throne, sort of staring at people.
So we're looking at a king who certainly sees himself as well above his subjects. I wanted to know how far Ed took his research.
I have kind of learned over the years that it's only so useful. So on the one hand, I have a tendency to be a bit cerebral anyway, which isn't the most helpful default position for an actor. Because ideally you want to kind of be, you know, you want to be reacting reflexively, and that's more about guts. It's good to have it as sort of background radiation, really, and allow it to kind of bleed through as and when it will kind of just sort of naturally bleed through. But really, you know, you have to obey what's on the page to a great extent. I mean, even given the you know, the truism that actors are forever rewriting their lines on the spot and kind of saying, I don't think I'm going to say that, love. Is that all right? But basically, whatever the writer tells you to do, you've sort of got to do it. So, yeah, I did do a certain amount of research and, you know, just a certain amount of, and I sort of like to write, little kind of biographies and stuff. I will just use, just sort of things, just kind of, I just sort of, it's a bit like, it's like blue sky thinking, except there's no whiteboard and no one else is in the room. It's a bit like that. And then you kind of put that bit of paper, you know, you put those sheets of paper in a drawer and never think about them again. But you've kind of thought about them for a bit. And in a funny way, that's enough, I think. You know, you can't, in the middle of playing a scene, you can't be thinking, oh God, well, yes, Mummy stole his favorite blankie when he was 7. So, yes, I should probably react violently and quite irrationally at this moment. You can't be doing that nonsense.
Ed Stoppard there on how he developed King Philip IV. But let's go back to his on-screen wife.
It's such a pleasure to have the opportunity to, you know, to suddenly get given, you know, a theme, a world, and be able to dive into it. And women in the Middle Ages is a really, really interesting theme, you know. And then watched documentaries. And we also spoke a lot, funny enough, about Princess Diana and how that was a kind of parallel. That sort of fragility of being married into an institution that has its... That works really well and has its own limitation, but everyone just accepts it as it is. And to be someone who doesn't want to accept it as it is, who's very, very sensitive and very romantic and very sort of very generous to the people. For instance, the relation that Diana had to people and how much she was loved. And, you know, there's a similarity in Joan, you know, in her relation to the people of Navarre and how, you know, they had her face on the coins and, you know, that was telling of how much the people loved her. What I always find really inspiring is kind of poetry, vivid poetry, you know, like reading, I was reading Claire, there's a translation of Ovid's Heroines by a new poet called Claire Pollard, which is all kind of soliloquies of famous female characters from the Roman ages, you know, like, Berenice and Helen of Troy, and the way it's written is very epic. Obviously, it's epic poetry, you know, but they're all first person, so it's all these women's experiences, and that I find actually sometimes even more helpful, something that triggers your imagination.
I love that. In a story about historical men battling it out with each other, here we have this character that's been woefully underserved by historians.
Now, I think that's the problem historically anyway with women being underwritten. She's like a classic case of, of an extraordinary character and historical character. And why is she so underwritten? I mean, I think it's because Philip the Fair was, you know, he did such major changes to France that, you know, that he is therefore more, you know, the center focused of that time. But there should be more about her anyway, because she is amazing. And I think that is the, you know, the classic case of, you know, it's like this documentary also that I had seen before, but watched again, you know, in preparation for this, The Ascent of Women. Again, so many extraordinary female characters across history that even if they build stuff, you know, physical monuments and everything, there is a tendency for basically male writing to wipe them off and sort of, you know, make us forget about them a bit. So it's great that that Joan has such an amazing part in the show, because you kind of think, oh, gosh, how do we not all know about, you know, about Joan of Navarre, you know? I think she's like, you know, a medieval feminist icon. I think she needs to be known, because she is extraordinary.
Now, as always, I want to hear from you, and this week's postbag of questions, by which I mean my Twitter mentions, is almost bulging with fan mail. As usual, this is emphatically not for me, but I do want to read out this question from Stacey Glover on Twitter, who wants us to talk a bit more in a future episode about the Pope. She says, as a fan of Jim Carter's, can you tell us a bit about his casting, his take on that character, and his storyline? That is a brilliant question, which makes me think that we ought to get Jim on the show. So, Jim, if you're listening, please call in. Jim? We'll call his agent. Meanwhile, if you've got a question for us, please search for Nightfall or History on Facebook and Twitter, or tweet me directly at DG Jones using the Nightfall hashtag, and I'll do my best to address your questions here. All of which brings us to a close, but next time, we're all about the Holy Grail. Thanks for listening. You chose wisely. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.